banned Marxist books, taking care to hide them from the police, and I was not entirely unsympathetic to the communist line. But I had seen too much to swallow at home. Thanks to my work with intelligence, I knew very well the bloody history of oppression in Mongolia carried out by Stalin and his puppet dictators. Ever since the revolution, they had sent tens of thousands of Lamaist priests and landowners and other forces of opposition to concentration camps, where they were cruelly liquidated. And the same kind of thing had happened in the Soviet Union itself. Even if I could have believed in the communist ideology, I could no longer believe in the people or the system that was responsible for putting that ideology and those principles into practice. I felt the same way about what we Japanese had done in Manchuria. I'm sure you can't imagine the number of Chinese laborers killed in the course of constructing the secret base at Hai La, killed with the express purpose of shutting them up to protect the secrecy of the base's construction plans. Besides, I had witnessed that hellish skinning carried out by the Russian officer and his Mongolian subordinates. I had been thrown into a Mongolian well, and in that strange, intense light I had lost any passion for living. How could someone like me believe in ideology and politics? As an interpreter, I worked as a liaison between Japanese prisoners of war in the mine and their Soviet captors. I don't know what it was like in the other Siberian concentration camps, but in the mine where I worked, streams of people were dying every day. Not that there was any dearth of causes. Malnutrition, overwork, cave-ins, floods, unsanitary conditions that gave rise to epidemics, winter cold of unbelievable harshness, violent guards, the brutal suppression of the mildest resistance. There were cases, too, of lynchings of Japanese by their fellow Japanese. What people felt for each other under such circumstances was hatred and doubt and fear and despair. Whenever the number of deaths increased to the point where the labor force was declining, they would bring in whole trainloads of new prisoners of war. The men would be dressed in rags, emaciated, and a good quarter of them would die within the first few weeks, unable to withstand the harsh conditions in the mine. The dead would be thrown into abandoned mine shafts. It was impossible to dig graves for them all. The earth was frozen solid there year-round. Shovels couldn't dent it. So the abandoned mine shafts were perfect for disposing of the dead. They were deep and dark, and because of the cold, there was no smell. Now and then we would put a layer of coal over the bodies. When a shaft filled up, they would cap it with dirt and rocks, then move on to the next shaft. The dead were not the only ones thrown into the shafts. Sometimes living men would be thrown in to teach the rest of us a lesson. Any Japanese soldier who showed signs of resistance would be taken out by Soviet guards and beaten to a pulp, his arms and legs broken before they dropped him to the bottom of the pit. To this day, I can still hear their pitiful screams. It was a living hell. The mine was run as a major strategic facility by Politburo members dispatched from Party Central and policed by the army with maximum security. The top man was said to be from Stalin's own hometown, a cold, hard party functionary, still young and full of ambition. His only concern was to raise production figures. The consumption of laborers was a matter of indifference to him. As long as the production figures went up, Party Central would recognize his mine as exemplary and reward him with an expanded labor force. No matter how many workers died, they would always be replaced. To keep the figures rising, he would authorize the digging of veins that, under ordinary circumstances, would have been considered too dangerous to work. Naturally, the number of accidents continued to rise as well. But he didn't care about that. The director was not the only cold-hearted individual supervising the mine. Most of the guards inside the mine were former convicts, uneducated men of shocking cruelty and vindictiveness. They displayed no sign of sympathy or affection, as if, living out here at the edge of the earth, they had been transformed over the years by the frigid Siberian air into subhuman creatures. They had committed crimes and been sent to Siberian prisons, but now that they had served their long sentences, they no longer had homes or families to go back to. They had taken local wives, had children with them, and settled into the Siberian soil. Japanese prisoners of war were not the only ones sent to work in the mine. There were many Russian criminals as well, political prisoners and former military officers who were victims of Stalin's purges. Not a few of these men were well-educated, refined individuals. Among the Russians were a very few women and children, probably the scattered remains of political prisoners' families. They would be put to work collecting rubbish, washing clothes, and other such tasks. Young women were often used as prostitutes. Besides the Russians, the trains would bring Poles, Hungarians, and other foreigners, some with dusky skins, Armenians and Kurds, I should imagine. The camp was partitioned into three living areas, the largest one where Japanese prisoners of war were kept together, the area for criminals and other prisoners of war, and the area for non-criminals. In this last there lived regular miners and mining professionals, officers, and guards of the military guard detachment, some with families and ordinary Russian citizens. There was also a large army post near the station. Prisoners of war and other prisoners were forbidden to leave their assigned areas. The areas were divided from each other by massive barbed wire fences, patrolled by soldiers carrying machine guns. As a translator with liaison duties, I had to visit headquarters each day and was free to move from area to area as long as I showed my pass. Near headquarters was the railway station, and a kind of one-street town with a few shabby stores, a bar, and an inn for officials and high-ranking officers on inspection tours. The square was lined with horse troughs, and a big red flag of the USSR flew from a flagpole in the center. Beneath the flag was parked an armored vehicle with a machine gun against which there was always leaning a bored-looking young soldier in full military gear. The newly built military hospital was situated at the far end of the square, with a large statue of Joseph Stalin at its entrance. There is a man I must tell you about now. I encountered him in the spring of 1947, probably around the beginning of May, when the snow had finally melted. A year and a half had already passed since I was sent to the mine. When I first saw him, the man was wearing the kind of uniform they gave to all the Russian prisoners. He was involved in repair work at the station with a group of some 10 of his compatriots. They were breaking up rocks with sledgehammers and spreading the crushed rock over the roadway. The clanging of the hammers against the hard rocks reverberated throughout the area. I was on my way back from delivering a report to mine headquarters when I passed the station. The non-commissioned officer directing the work stopped me and ordered me to show my pass. I took it from my pocket and handed it to him. The sergeant, a large man, focused a suspicious gaze on the pass for some time. But he was obviously illiterate. He called over one of the prisoners at work on the road and told the man to read it aloud. This particular prisoner was different from the others in his group. He had the look of a well-educated man, and it was him. When I saw him, I could feel the blood drain from my face. I could hardly breathe. Literally, I felt as if I were underwater, drowning. My breath would not come. This educated prisoner was none other than the Russian officer who had ordered the Mongolian soldiers to skin Yamamoto alive on the bank of the Kalka River. He was emaciated now, almost bald and missing a front tooth. Instead of his spotless officer's uniform, he wore filthy prison garb, and instead of shiny boots, he wore cloth shoes that were full of holes. The lenses of his glasses were dirty and scratched. The frames were twisted. But it was the same man, without a doubt. There was no way I could have failed to recognize him, and he, in turn, was staring hard at me, his curiosity first aroused, no doubt, by my own stunned expression. Like him, I had also aged and wasted away in the 9 intervening years. I even had a few white hairs now, but he seemed to recognize me nonetheless. A look of astonishment crossed his face. He must have assumed that I had rotted away in the bottom of a Mongolian well, and I, of course, never dreamed that I would run across him in a Siberian mining camp wearing prisoner's garb. A moment was all it took him to regain his composure and begin reading my pass in calm tones to the illiterate sergeant, who had a machine gun slung from his neck. He read my name, my job as translator, my qualification to move among camp areas, and so on. The sergeant returned my pass and signaled me with a jerk of the chin to go. I walked on a short way and turned around. The man was looking at me. He seemed to be wearing a faint smile, though it might have been my imagination. My legs were shaking, and I couldn't walk straight for a while. All the terror I had experienced 9 years before had come back to me in an instant. I imagined that the man had fallen from grace and been sent to this Siberian prison camp. Such things were not at all rare in the Soviet Union back then. Vicious struggles were going on within the government, the party, and the military, and Stalin's pathological suspiciousness pursued the losers without mercy. Stripped of their positions, such men would be tried in kangaroo courts and either executed or sent to concentration camps, though finally which group was the more fortunate only a god could say. An escape from death led only to slave labor of unimaginable cruelty. We Japanese prisoners of war could at least hope to return to our homeland if we survived. But exiled Russians knew no such hope. Like the others, this man would end up with his bones rotting in the soil of Siberia. Only one thing bothered me about him, and that was that he now knew my name and where to find me. Before the war, I had participated, unknowingly to be sure, in that secret operation with the spy Yamamoto, crossing the Kalka River into Mongolian territory for espionage activities. If the man should leak this information, it could put me in a very uncomfortable position. However, he did not inform on me. No. As I was to discover later, he had far more grandiose plans for me. I spotted him a week later outside the station. He was in chains still, wearing the same filthy prison clothes and cracking rocks with a hammer. I looked at him, and he looked at me. He rested his hammer on the ground and turned my way, standing as tall and straight as he had when in military uniform. This time, unmistakably, He wore a smile on his face, a faint smile, but still a smile, one suggesting a streak of cruelty that sent chills up my spine. It was the same expression he had worn as he watched Yamamoto being skinned alive. I said nothing and passed on. I had one friend at the time among the officers in the camp Soviet Army headquarters. Like me, he had specialized in geography in college in Leningrad. We were the same age, and both of us were interested in making maps, so we would find pretexts now and then for indulging in a little shop talk. He had a personal interest in the strategic maps of Manchuria that the Kwantung Army had been making. Of course, we couldn't have such conversations when his superiors were around. We had to snatch opportunities to enjoy this professional patter in their absence. Sometimes he would give me food or show me pictures of the wife and children he had left behind in Kiev. He was the only Russian I felt at all close to during the period I was interned in the Soviet Union. One time, in an offhand manner, I asked him about the convicts working by the station. One man in particular had struck me as different from the usual inmate. I said he looked as if he might once have held an important post. I described his appearance. The officer, whose name was Nikolai, said to me with a scowl, "That would be Boris the Manskinner. You'd better not have anything to do with him." "Why was that?" I asked. Nikolai seemed hesitant to say more, but he knew I was in a position to do him favors. So reluctantly he told me how Boris the Manskinner had been sent to this mine. "Now, don't tell anyone I told you," he warned me. "That guy is dangerous. I'm not joking. They don't come any worse. I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. This is what Nikolai told me. The real name of Boris the Manskinner was Boris Gromov. Just as I had imagined, he had been a major in the NKVD. They had assigned him to Ulaanbaatar as a military advisor in 1938, the year Choi Balsan took power as prime minister. There he organized the Mongolian secret police, modeling it after Beria's NKVD, and he distinguished himself in suppressing counter-revolutionary forces. They would round people up, throw them into concentration camps, and torture them, liquidating anyone of whom they had the slightest suspicion. As soon as the Battle of Nomonhan ended and the Far Eastern crisis was averted, Boris was called back to Moscow and reassigned to Soviet-occupied Eastern Poland, where he worked on the purging of the old Polish army. That is where he earned the nickname Boris the Manskinner. Skinning people alive, using a man they said he brought with him from Mongolia, was his special form of torture. The Poles were scared to death of him, needless to say. Anyone forced to watch a skinning would confess everything without fail. When the German army suddenly burst across the border and the war started with Germany, he pulled back from Poland to Moscow. Lots of people were arrested at that time on suspicion of having colluded with Hitler. They would be executed or sent to prison camps. Here again, Boris distinguished himself as Beria's right-hand man, employing his special torture. Stalin and Beria had to cook up an internal conspiracy theory, covering up their own responsibility for having failed to predict the Nazi invasion in order to solidify their leadership. A lot of people died for nothing while being cruelly tortured. Boris and his man were said to have skinned at least 5 people then, and rumor had it that he proudly displayed the skins on the walls of his office. Boris may have been cruel, but he was also very careful, which is how he survived all the plots and purges. Beria loved him as a son, but this may have been what led him to become a little too sure of himself and to overstep the mark. The mistake he made was a fatal one. He arrested the commander of an armored battalion on suspicion of having secret communications with one of Hitler's SS armored battalions during a battle in the Ukraine. He killed the man after torturing him, poking hot irons into every opening, ears, nostrils, rectum, penis, whatever. But the officer turned out to be the nephew of a high-ranking Communist Party official. What's more, a thoroughgoing investigation by the Red Army General Staff showed the man to have been innocent of any wrongdoing. The party official blew up, of course, nor was the Red Army going to withdraw quietly after such a blot on its honor. Not even Beria was able to protect Boris this time. They stripped him of his rank, put him on trial, and sentenced both him and his Mongolian adjutant to death. The NKVD went to work, though, and got his sentence reduced to hard labor in a concentration camp, though the Mongolian was hanged. Beria sent a secret message to Boris in prison, promising to pull strings in the army and the party. He would get him out and restore him to power after he had served a year in the camp. At least this was how Nikolai had heard it. "So you see, Mamia," Nikolai said to me, keeping his voice low, "everybody thinks Boris is going back to Moscow someday, but Beria is sure to save him before too long. It's true that Beria has to be careful. This camp is still run by the party and the army. But none of us can relax. The direction of the wind can shift just like that. And when it does, anybody who's given him a tough time here is in for it. The world may be full of idiots, but nobody's stupid enough to sign his own death warrant. We have to tiptoe around him. He's an honored guest here. Of course, we can't give him servants and treat him as if he were in a hotel. For the sake of appearances, we have to put chains on his leg and give him a few rocks to crack. But in fact, he has his own room and all the alcohol and tobacco he wants. If you ask me, he's like a poison snake. Keeping him alive is not going to do anybody any good. Somebody ought to sneak in there one night and slash his throat for him."
Another day, when I was walking by the station, that big sergeant stopped me again. I started to take out my pass, but he shook his head and told me to go instead to the station master's office. Puzzled, I did as I was told and found in the office not the station master, but Boris Gromov. He sat at the desk, drinking tea while waiting for me to arrive. I froze in the doorway. He no longer had leg irons on. With his hand, he gestured for me to come in. "Nice to see you, Lieutenant Mamia. It's been years," he said cheerily, flashing a big smile. He offered me a cigarette, but I shook my head. "9 years, to be precise," he continued, lighting up. "Or is it 8? Anyhow, it's wonderful to see you alive and well. What a joy to meet old friends. Especially after such a brutal war. Don't you agree? And how did you manage to get out of that well?" I just stood there, saying nothing. "All right then, never mind. The important thing is that you did get out. And then you lost a hand somewhere. And then you learned to speak such fluent Russian. Wonderful, wonderful. You can always make do without a hint. What matters most is that you are alive."
"Not by choice," I replied. Boris laughed aloud, Ah, you're such an interesting fellow, Lieutenant Mamiya. You would choose not to live, and yet here you are very much alive.
Yes, a truly interesting fellow. But I am not so easily fooled. No ordinary man could have escaped from that deep well by himself. Escaped and found his way back across the river to Manchuria. But don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Enough about you, though. Let me tell you about myself. As you can see, I lost my former position and am now a mere prisoner in a concentration camp. But I do not intend to stay here on the edge of the earth forever, breaking rocks with a sledgehammer. I am as powerful as ever back at Party Central, and I am using that power to increase my power here day by day. And so I will tell you in all frankness that I want to have good relations with you Japanese prisoners of war. The productivity of this mine depends on you men, on your numbers and your hard work. We can accomplish nothing if we ignore your power. And that includes your own individual power, Lieutenant Mamiya. I want you to lend me some of what you have. You are a former intelligence officer of the Kwantung Army and a very brave man. You speak fluent Russian. If you would act as my liaison, I am in a position to do favors for yourself and your comrades. This is not a bad deal that I am offering you. I have never been a spy, I declared, and I have no intention of becoming one now. I am not asking you to become a spy, Barra said, as if to calm me down. All I'm saying is that I can make things easier for your people. I am offering to improve relations, and I want you to be the go-between. Together, we can knock the shit-eating Georgian Politburo son of a bitch out of his chair. I can do it. Don't kid yourself. I'm sure you Japanese hate his guts. Once we get rid of him, you people will be able to have partial autonomy. You can form committees. You can run your own organization. Then at least you'll be able to stop the guards from dishing out brutal treatment any time they like. That's what you've all been hoping for, isn't it? Boris was right about that. We had been appealing to the camp authorities about these matters for a long time, and they would always turn us down flat. "And what do you want in return?" I asked. "Almost nothing," he said with a big smile, holding both arms out. "All I am looking for is close, friendly relations with you Japanese prisoners of war. I want to eliminate a few of my party comrades, my tovarishes, with whom it seems I am unable to achieve any understanding. And I need your people's cooperation to accomplish that. We have many interests in common, so why don't we join forces for our mutual benefit? What is it the Americans say? Give and take? If you cooperate with me, I won't do anything to your disadvantage. I have no tricks up my sleeve. I know, of course, that I am in no position to ask you to like me. You and I share some unpleasant memories, to be sure. But appearances aside, I am a man of honor. I always keep my promises. So why don't we let bygones be bygones? Take a few days, think about my offer, and let me have a firm reply. I believe it's worth a try. You men have nothing to lose, don't you agree? Now make sure you mention this only to people you are quite sure you can trust. A few of your men are informers working with the Politburo member. Make sure they don't get wind of this. Things could turn sour if they found out. My power here is still somewhat limited. I went back to my area and took one man aside to discuss Boris's offer. This fellow had been a lieutenant colonel in the army. He was a tough man with a sharp mind. Commander of a unit that had shut itself up in a Kingan mountain fortress and refused to raise the white flag even after Japan's surrender. He was now the unofficial leader of the camp's Japanese prisoners of war, a force the Russians had to reckon with. Concealing the incident with Yamamoto on the banks of the Karka, I told him that Boris had been a high-ranking officer in the secret police and explained his offer. The colonel seemed interested in the idea of eliminating the present Politburo member and securing some autonomy for the Japanese prisoners of war. I stressed that Boris was a cold-blooded and dangerous man, a past master of deceit and trickery, who could not be taken at face value. "You may be right," said the colonel, "but so is our Politburo friend. We have nothing to lose." And he was right. If something came out of the deal, it couldn't make things any worse for us than they already were, I thought. But I couldn't have been more wrong. Hell has no true bottom. A few days later, I was able to arrange a private meeting between the colonel and Boris in a place away from prying eyes. I acted as interpreter. A secret pact resulted from their 30-minute discussion, and the two shook hands. I have no way of knowing exactly what happened after that. The two avoided direct contact, so as not to attract attention, and instead they seemed to have engaged in a constant exchange of coded messages, using some secret means of communication. This ended my role as intermediary, which was fine with me. If possible, I wanted nothing more to do with Boris. Only later would I realize that such a thing was anything but possible. As Boris had promised, about a month later, Party Central removed the Georgian Politburo member from office and sent a new member to take his place 2 days after that. Another 2 days went by, and three Japanese prisoners of war were strangled during the night. They were found hanging from beams to make the deaths look like suicides. But these were clearly lynchings carried out by other Japanese. The three must have been the informers, Boris had mentioned. There was never any investigation. By then, Boris had the camp in the palm of his hand.
31. The bat vanishes. The thieving magpie returns. Wearing a sweater and coat, a woolen hat pulled down low almost to my eyes, I scaled the back wall and lowered myself into the alley. The sun would not be up for a while, and people were still asleep. I padded my way down the alley to the residence. Inside, the house was just as I had left it 6 days earlier, complete with dirty dishes in the sink. I found no written messages and nothing on the answering machine. The computer screen in Cinnamon's room was as cold and dead as before. The heating was keeping the place at normal room temperature. I took off my coat and gloves, then boiled a kettle and made myself some tea. I had a few biscuits and cheese for breakfast, washed the dishes in the sink, and put them away. 9 o'clock came, again with no sign of Cinnamon. I went out to the yard, took the cover off the well, and leaned over to look inside. There was the same dense darkness. I knew the well now as if it were an extension of my own body. Its darkness, its smell, and its quiet were part of me. In a sense, I knew the well better than I knew Kumiko. Her memory was still fresh, of course. If I closed my eyes, I could bring back the details of her voice, her face, her body, the way she moved. I had lived in the same house with her for 6 years, after all. But still, I felt there were things about her that I could not bring back so clearly. Or perhaps I simply could not be sure that what I was remembering was correct, just as I could not recall with certainty the curve in the tail of the cat when he came back. I sat on the edge of the well, thrust my hands into my coat pockets, and surveyed my surroundings once again. It felt as if a cold rain or snow might begin falling at any time. There was no wind, but the air had a deep chill to it. A flock of little birds raced back and forth across the sky in a complex pattern, as if painting a hieroglyph, and then, with a rush, they were gone. Soon I heard the low rumble of a jet, but the plane stayed invisible above the thick layer of clouds. On such a dark, overcast day, I could go into the well without worrying that the sunlight would hurt my eyes when I came out. Still, I went on sitting there for some time, doing nothing. I was in no hurry. The day had hardly begun. Noon would not be here for a while. I gave myself up to thoughts that came in no particular order as I sat on the edge of the well. Where had they taken the bird sculpture that used to be in this yard? Was it decorating another yard now, still urged on by an endless, pointless impulse to soar into the sky? Or had it been discarded as junk when the Miyawaki's house was demolished last summer? I recalled the piece fondly. Without the sculpture of the bird, I felt the yard had lost a certain subtle balance. When I ran out of thoughts, after 11, I climbed down the steel ladder into the well. I set foot on the well bottom and took a few deep breaths, as always, checking the air. It was the same as ever, smelling of mold, but breathable. I felt for the bat where I had left it propped against the wall. It was not there. It was not anywhere. It had disappeared, completely, without a trace. I lowered myself to the well floor and sat leaning against the wall, sighing. Who could have taken the bat? Cinnamon was the only possibility. He was the only one who knew of its existence, and he was the only one who would think to climb down into the well. But what reason could he possibly have for taking the bat away? This was something I could not comprehend. One of many things I could not comprehend. I had no choice today but to go ahead without the bat. That would be all right. The bat was, after all, just a kind of protective talisman. Not having it with me would pose no problem. I had managed to get into that room without it, hadn't I? Once I'd presented these arguments to myself, I pulled on the rope that closed the lid of the well. I folded my hands on my knees and closed my eyes in the darkness. As had happened last time, I was unable to achieve the mental concentration I wanted. All kinds of thoughts came crowding in, blocking the way. To get rid of them, I tried thinking about the pool, the 25-meter indoor pool where I went for exercise. I imagined myself doing laps of the crawl there. I am not aiming for speed, just using a quiet, steady stroke over and over again. I bring my elbows out with a minimum of noise and splashing, then stroke gently, fingers first. I take water into my mouth and let it out slowly, as if breathing underwater. After a while, I feel my body flowing naturally through the water, as if riding on a soft wind. The only sound reaching my ears is that of my own regular breathing. I'm floating on the wind like a bird in the sky, looking down at the earth below. I see distant towns and tiny people and flowing rivers. A sense of calm envelops me, a feeling close to rapture. Swimming is one of the best things in my life. It has never solved any problems, but it has done no harm, and nothing has ever ruined it for me. Swimming. Just then, I heard something. I realized I could hear a low, monotonous hum in the dark, something like the droning of insect wings. But the sound was too artificial, too mechanical to be insect wings. It had subtle variations in frequency, like tuning changes in a shortwave broadcast. I held my breath and listened, trying to catch its direction. It seemed to be coming from a fixed point in the darkness and at the same time from inside my own head. The border between the two was almost impossible to determine in the deep darkness. While concentrating all my attention on the sound, I fell asleep. I had no awareness of feeling sleepy before that happened. All of a sudden, I was asleep, as if I'd been walking down a corridor with nothing particular on my mind when, without warning, I was dragged into an unknown room. How long this thick, mud-like stupor enveloped me, I had no idea. It couldn't have been very long. It might have been just a moment. But when some kind of presence brought me back to consciousness, I knew I was in another darkness. The air was different. The temperature was different. The quality and depth of the darkness were different. This darkness was tainted with some kind of faint, opaque light. And a familiar sharp smell of pollen struck my nostrils. I was in that strange hotel room. I raised my face, scanned my surroundings, held my breath. I had come through the wall. I was sitting on a carpeted floor, my back leaning against a cloth-covered wall. My hands were still folded on my knees, as fearful and deep as my sleep had been just a moment before. My wakefulness now was complete and lucid. The contrast was so extreme that it took a moment for my wakefulness to sink in. The quick contractions of my heart were plainly audible. There was no doubt about it. I was here. I had at last made it all the way into the room. In the fine-grained, multi-veiled darkness, the room looked exactly as I remembered it. As my eyes became used to the darkness, though, I began to pick out slight differences. First, the telephone was in a different place. It had moved from the night table to the top of a pillow, in which it was now all but buried. Then I saw that the amount of whiskey in the bottle had gone down. There was just a little left in the bottom now. All the ice in the bucket had melted and was now nothing but old, cloudy water. The glass was dry inside, and when I touched it, I realized it was coated with white dust. I approached the bed, lifted the phone, and put the receiver to my ear. The line was dead. The room looked as if it had been abandoned, forgotten for a very long time. There was no sense of a human presence there. Only the flowers in the vase preserved their strange vividness. There were signs that someone had been lying in the bed. The sheets and covers and pillows were in slight disarray. I pulled back the covers and checked for warmth, but there was none. No smell of perfume remained either. Much time seemed to have elapsed since the person had left the bed. I sat on the edge of the bed, scanned the room again, and listened for sounds. But I heard nothing. The place was like an ancient tomb after grave robbers had carried off the body. All of a sudden, the phone began to ring. My heart froze like a frightened cat. The air's sharp reverberations woke the floating grains of pollen, and the flower petals raised their faces in the darkness. How could the phone have been ringing? Only a few moments before, it had been as dead as a rock in the earth. I steadied my breathing, calmed the beating of my heart, and checked to make sure I was still there in the room. I stretched out my hand, touched the receiver, and hesitated a moment before lifting it from its cradle. By then, the phone had rung three or perhaps four times. "Hello?" The phone went dead as I lifted the receiver. The irreversible heaviness of death weighed in my hand like a sandbag. "Hello?" I said again, but my own dry voice came back to me unaltered, as if rebounding from a thick wall. I replaced the receiver, then picked it up again and listened. There was no sound. I sat on the edge of the bed, trying to control my breathing as I waited for the phone to ring again. It did not ring. I watched the grains in the air return to unconsciousness and sink into the darkness. I replayed the sound of the telephone in my mind. I was no longer entirely certain that it had rung at all. But if I let doubts like that creep in, there would have been no end to them. I had to draw a line somewhere. Otherwise, my very existence in this place would have been open to question. The phone had rung. There could be no mistake. And in the next instant, it had gone dead. I cleared my throat. But that sound, too, died instantly in the air. I stood up and made a circuit of the room. I studied the floor, stared up at the ceiling, sat on the table, leaned against the wall, gave the doorknob a quick twist, flicked the switch of the floor lamp on and off. The doorknob didn't budge, of course, and the lamp was dead. The window was boarded from outside. I listened out for any sounds, but the silence was like a smooth, high wall. Still, I felt the presence of something trying to deceive me, as if the others were holding their breath, pressing themselves flat against the wall, obliterating their skin color to keep me from knowing they were there. So I pretended not to notice. We were very good at fooling each other. I cleared my throat again and touched my fingers to my lips. I decided to inspect the room once more. I tried the floor lamp again, but it produced no light. I opened the whiskey bottle and sniffed what was left inside. The smell was unchanged. Cutty Sark. I replaced the cap and returned the bottle to the table. I put the receiver to my ear one more time, but the phone could not have been any deader. I took a few slow steps to get a feel of the carpet against my shoes. I pressed my ear against the wall and concentrated all my attention in an attempt to hear any sounds that might have been coming through it. But there was, of course, nothing. I stepped to the door, and knowing that to do so was pointless, gave the knob a twist. It turned easily to the right. For a moment, I could not absorb this fact. Before, the knob had been so solid it could have been set in cement. I went back to square one and tried again, taking my hand from the knob, reaching out for it again, and turning it back and forth. It turned smoothly in my hand. This gave me the strangest feeling, as if my tongue were swelling inside my mouth. The door was open. I pulled the knob until the door swung open just enough for a blinding light to come streaming into the room. The bat! If only I had the bat, I would have felt more confident. Oh, forget the bat! I swung the door wide open. Checking left, then right, to be sure no one was there, I stepped outside. It was a long, carpeted corridor. A little way down the corridor, I could see a large vase filled with flowers. It was the vase I had hidden behind while the whistling waiter was knocking on this door. In my memory, the corridor was a long one, with many turns and branches along the way. I'd managed to get here by coming across the waiter whistling his way down the corridor and following him. The number plate on the door had identified this as room 208. Stepping with care, I walked towards the vase. I hoped I could find my way to the lobby where Noboru Wataya had been appearing on television. Many people had been in the lobby, moving to and fro. I might be able to find some clue there, but wandering through the hotel was like venturing into a vast desert without a compass. If I couldn't find the lobby, and then was unable to find my way back to room 208, I might be sealed up inside this labyrinthine place, unable to return to the real world. But now was no time for hesitation. It could be my last chance. I had waited every day on the bottom of the well for 6 months, and now, at last, the door had opened before me. Besides, the well was going to be taken from me soon. If I failed now, all my time and effort would have been for nothing. I turned several corners. My filthy tennis shoes moved without a sound over the carpet. I couldn't hear a thing. No voices, no music, no TV, not even a ventilator fan or a lift. The hotel was silent. Like a ruin forgotten by time. I turned many corners and passed many doors. The corridor forked again and again, and I always turned right, on the assumption that if I chose to go back, I should be able to find the room by taking only lefts. By now, though, my sense of direction was gone. I felt no nearer to anything in particular. The numbers on the doors had no order, and they went by endlessly, so they were no help at all. They trickled away from my consciousness almost before they had registered in my memory. Now and then I felt I had passed some of them before. I came to a stop in the middle of the corridor and caught my breath. Was I circling back over and over the same territory, the way one does when lost in the woods? As I stood there wondering what to do, I heard a familiar sound in the distance. It was the whistling waiter. He was in perfect tune. There was no one to match him. As before, he was whistling the overture to Rossini's The Thieving Magpie. Not an easy tune to whistle, but it seemed to give him no trouble. I proceeded down the corridor in the direction of the whistling, which grew louder and clearer. He appeared to be heading in my direction. I found a good-sized pillar and hid behind it. The waiter carried a silver tray again, with the usual bottle of Cutty Sark and an ice bucket and two glasses. He hurried past me, facing straight ahead, with an expression on his face that suggested he was entranced by the sound of his own whistling. He didn't look in my direction. He was in such a hurry that he couldn't spare a moment's wasted motion. "Everything is the same as before," I thought. It seemed my flesh was being carried back in time. As soon as the waiter passed me, I followed him. His silver tray bobbed pleasantly in time with the tune he was whistling, now and then catching the glare of a ceiling light. He repeated the melody of the thieving magpie over and over like a magic spell. What kind of opera was the thieving magpie, I wondered. All I knew about it was the monotonous melody of its overture and its mysterious title. We had a recording of the overture in the house when I was a boy. It had been conducted by Toscanini. Compared with Claudio Abbado's youthful, fluid, contemporary performance, Toscanini's had a blood-stirring intensity to it, like the slow strangulation of a powerful foe who has been downed after a violent battle. But was the thieving magpie really the story of a magpie that engaged in thievery? If things ever settle down, I would have to go to the library and look it up in an encyclopedia of music. I might even buy a complete recording of the opera if it was available. Or maybe not. I might not care to know the answers to these questions by then. The whistling waiter continued walking straight ahead with all the mechanical regularity of a robot, and I followed him at a fixed distance. I knew where he was going without even having to think about it. He was delivering the fresh bottle of Cutty Sark and the ice in glasses to room 208. And indeed, he came to a stop in front of room 208. He shifted the tray to his left hand, checked the room number, drew himself up, and gave the door a perfunctory knock. Three knocks. Then another three. I couldn't tell whether there was any answer from within. I was hiding behind the vase, watching the waiter. Time passed, but the waiter went on standing to attention, as though attempting to challenge the limits of endurance. He did not knock again, but waited for the door to open. Eventually, as if in answer to a prayer, the door began to open inwards. 32. The job of making others use their imaginations. The story of Boris the Manskinner continued.
Boris kept his promise. We Japanese war prisoners were given partial autonomy and allowed to form a representative committee. The colonel was the committee chairman. From then on, the Russian guards, both civil and military, were ordered to cease their violent behavior, and the committee became responsible for keeping order in the camp. As long as we caused no trouble and met our production quotas, they would leave us alone. That was the ostensible policy of the new Politburo member, which is to say, the policy of Boris. These reforms, at first glance so democratic, should have been great news for us prisoners of war. But things were not as simple as they seemed. Taken up with welcoming the new reforms, we were too stupid to see the cunning trap that Boris had set for us. Supported by the secret police, Boris was in a far more powerful position than a new Politburo member, and he proceeded to transform the camp and the town as he saw fit. Intrigue and terrorism became the order of the day. Boris chose the strongest and most vicious men from among the prisoners and the civilian guards, of which there was no small supply, trained them, and made them into his own personal bodyguards. Armed with guns and knives and clubs, this hand-picked contingent would take care of anyone who resisted Boris, threatening and physically abusing them, sometimes even beating them to death on Boris's orders. No one could lay a hand on them. The soldiers sent from regular army units to guard the mine would pretend not to see what was happening under their noses. By then, not even the army could touch Boris. Soldiers stayed in the background, keeping watch over the railway station and their own barracks, adopting an attitude of indifference with regard to what went on in the mine and the camp. Boris's favorite among his hand-picked guard was a prisoner known as the Tartar, who had supposedly been a Mongolian wrestling champion. The man stuck to Boris like a shadow. He had a big burn scar on his right cheek, which people said he had got during torture. Boris no longer wore prison clothes. and he moved into a neat little cottage that was kept clean for him by a woman inmate. According to Nikolai, who was becoming more and more reluctant to talk about anything, several Russians he knew had simply disappeared in the night. Officially, they were listed as missing or having been involved in accidents, but there was no doubt they had been taken care of by Boris's henchmen. People's lives were now in danger if they failed to follow Boris's orders or if they merely failed to please him. A few men tried to complain directly to Party Central about the abuses going on in camp, but that was the last anyone ever saw of them. I heard they even killed a little kid, a 7-year-old, to keep his parents in line. Beat him to death while they watched, Nikolai whispered to me, pale-faced. At first, Boris did nothing so crude as that in the Japanese zone. He concentrated his energies instead on gaining complete control over the Russian guards in the area and solidifying his foothold there. He seemed willing for the moment to leave the Japanese prisoners in charge of their own affairs. And so, for the first few months after the reform, we were able to enjoy a brief interval of peace. Those were tranquil days for us, a period of genuine calm. The committee was able to obtain some reduction in the harshness of the labor, however slight, and we no longer had to fear the violence of the guards. For the first time since our arrival, we were able to feel something like hope. People believed that things were going to get better. Not that Boris was ignoring us during those few honeymoon months. He was quietly arranging his pieces to gain the greatest strategic advantage. He worked on the Japanese committee members individually, behind the scenes, using bribes or threats to bring them under his control. He avoided overt violence, proceeding with the utmost caution, and so no one noticed what he was doing. When we did finally notice, it was too late. Under the guise of granting us autonomy, he was throwing us off our guard while he fashioned a still more efficient system of control. There was an icy, diabolical precision to his calculations. He succeeded in eliminating random violence from our lives, only to replace it with a new kind of coldly calculated violence. After 6 months of firming up his control structure, he changed direction and began applying pressure on us. His first victim was the man who had been the central figure on the committee, the colonel. He had confronted Boris directly to represent the interests of the Japanese prisoners of war on several issues, as a result of which he was eliminated. By that time, the colonel and a few of his cohorts were the only members of the committee who did not belong to Boris. They suffocated him one night, holding him down while one of them pressed a wet towel to his face. Boris ordered the job to be done, of course, though he never dirtied his own hands when it came to killing Japanese. He issued orders to the committee and had other Japanese do it. The colonel's death was written off simply as the result of illness. We all knew who had killed him, but no one could talk about it. We knew that Boris had spies among us, and we had to be careful what we said in front of anyone. After the colonel was murdered, the committee voted for Boris's hand-picked candidate to fill his chair. The work environment steadily deteriorated as a result of the change in the makeup of the committee, until eventually things were as bad as they had ever been. In exchange for our autonomy, we made arrangements with Boris concerning our production quotas, which became increasingly onerous. The quota was raised in stages, under one pretext or another, until finally the work forced upon us became harsher than ever. The number of accidents also escalated, and many Japanese soldiers lent their bones to the soil of a foreign land. Victims of reckless mining practices.